This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
So we're going green again in 2017. Is this our first one for 2017? Begley was in December, right? So our first one for 2017. A different world.
Very different world. I'm flattered, though. I'm honored. I'm opening up the new year.
This voice that you're hearing that isn't my irritating voice is none other than Philippe Cousteau. So this is Going Green. I'm Asher Levin. We're here with Philippe. I asked a bunch of questions that I haven't looked at, and we have a conversation about a topic that I'm not too fluent on. I think some of what we'll talk about I'm pretty fluent on, and then some of it I don't know anything about. So, how was your holiday?
Holiday was terrific. We actually, you know, I went to university in Scotland, so we went back to Edinburgh for New Year's, which is the second biggest New Year celebration, second only to New York. So it was a lot of fun.
That sounds fun. Yeah, that's great. Cool, man. Well, we have an announcement. We'll do it in the middle of here. You know about this thing that we're doing coming up that you're going to be a part of in March.
The Impact.
Yeah. Oh. Sorry. But yeah, we'll get into it when it makes sense in the questions, I guess.
Yeah.
I know you only have a small amount of time, so I'm just gonna
get like half hour.
Okay, good.
Plenty of time.
I talk a lot. A half hour is
plenty of time for me. Trust me. You don't want to listen to me that.
Okay,
long.
Cool. I just flipped it over. All right. Okay, this is a good one because this one I certainly don't know very much about, and I think you have decades of historical history on a lot of this. If we don't change anything about the way we pollute, I've never read this before. If we don't change anything about the way we pollute, fish, and release carbon into the atmosphere, in what shape do you see the ocean in 10 years? I'll do it differently. If we don't do any of that stuff in the next 8 years of this administration, where we won't be doing any of this stuff with the government, what do you think is going to happen?
Well, you know, a lot of the systems in the ocean that we rely on for survival are on the brink as it is. And I hate to be negative and doom and gloom, because that's not anything that anybody wants to be a part of. But the reality is, you know, we have a lot of issues around fisheries, bluefin tuna being kind of the poster child, especially here in LA where sushi is so popular. You know, there are a lot of fisheries that are on the brink of collapse. We have, you know, the Arctic is in pretty bad shape. We have, you know, obviously there are a lot of concerns around climate change, and that if we don't get a handle on carbon emissions, then we're going to miss some pretty critical targets of keeping the global temperature rise under some very important kind of thresholds.
And you've been, unlike some people on the show, or I'm guessing a lot of people that are hearing this, you've been to ground zero of a lot of these places.
And I have. And you know, I think that at the end of the day, you know, it's no surprise to anybody that we face a lot of problems in the world, particularly from an environmental perspective. And what I think a lot of people are beginning to realize is that when we think about these environmental issues, we have to think about them in the context of not just fish and polar bears and trees, but in the context of people. And for example, in the headlines today is the conflict in Syria. And what a lot of people don't remember is that extreme drought in Syria drove people out of the rural areas of Syria, collapsed farms and agricultural industry in Syria. They migrated to the cities, and the huge amounts of pressure and lack of jobs in those cities led to protests, which were cracked down upon by the Syrian government, and which then led to the broader revolution there.
You think that could happen? I'm obviously not here, probably not for a while, but do you think that could happen in other areas that aren't as obvious, you know?
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of environmental pressure. So, you know, in a nutshell, you can trace what's going on in Syria back to an environmental crisis. So the point of that is for people to recognize and remember that when we talk about conservation, when we talk about the environment, we talk about water and fish and all these different things, we're really talking about the security of people. We're talking about the opportunity. We're talking about simple rights, like in Flint, Michigan, here in the United States, of access to clean water as right. opposed to water that's going to irreparably damage the brains of your children for the rest of their lives. And I think in Southeast Asia, in Africa, we're going to have the largest population growth in the world in Africa over the next 30 years. There's huge pressures on these areas. Darfur in Sudan was largely an issue driven by drought. So we're going to have more of these conflicts over the next 10 years. And those have very real consequences for our security, because unlike, you know, say 100 years ago when you'd have wars in far off lands,
yeah.
they kind of stayed there. But now, as we know through terrorism, when people are disgruntled and unhappy, that they can reach across the planet and affect our lives as well. So these kinds of issues, it's very irresponsible when politicians are flippantly kind of dismissing issues around climate and water
and
all these issues.
Because
they're already affecting us.
Right.
And they're already contributing to terrorism and to crime and to, you know, destabilization.
Now, you know a lot about anthropology, about, you know, cycles, you know, obviously, you know, being educated in the ocean and the sort of biology of the ocean, you know that everything goes in cycles. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this fish's time now, and then there's a fish's time before, and then you know, this whale, and I don't know, I'm not, like I said, I know nothing about aquatics. But or I don't even know what would the term marine life?
Yeah, marine life is a good one.
That's good. That's great. I'm learning a lot. So my question to you is, I'm gonna pretend I'm conservative mm-hmm. for a second here mm-hmm. because apparently there are a lot of them in this country. if I said to you, well, you know, climate change, I understand the climate is changing, but 4,000 years ago, the dinosaur, where 15,000, how many, a million, how many years
dinosaurs
ago?
Were millions.
Millions, but, right, fine.
You know, 15,000 years ago that we really started to.
Right, when we started to evolve, right, okay, all right.
Domesticate and doing
sure.
agriculture
that,
and things like that.
There was a cycle where a whole, you know, species of a bunch of species died out. All these species, new species came in, mm-hmm. and there's lots of different theories about what happened, but some of them say, hey, it was, you know, Mother Nature, and this is the way that we cycle through societies, right? Mm-hmm. How are we to not just say, well, that's just what's happening now? I mean, obviously, we have tools, we've learned how to use these tools, and now these tools that we've learned to use are slowly destroying our civilizations.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing about the huge issue, the rapid extinction that's happening right now, past extinctions have taken thousands of millennia, you know, millions of years, hundreds of millennia, millions of years to happen. And we're causing the extinction of an untold amount of species on this planet. Some we haven't even discovered yet. They're disappearing at a rate unlike anything before. So we're accelerating that process. And, you know, I'll take bees for a great example. Human beings don't live in a vacuum. We cannot thrive and survive on this planet without abundance of diversity in wildlife and nature and wild places. Bees are, for example, an incredibly important element to the survival of human beings on this planet.
Absolutely.
As pollinators of crops
right.
and our food, etc. And without them, agricultural economies collapse, people don't eat, and that leads to all sorts of other problems that I don't need to. People can use their imagination. I don't need to describe them here. So we can't live in systems that aren't robust and diverse. And even if you've never seen or care about some animal somewhere, it matters that those animals exist on this planet because they're all part of a broader web and a network. And that's, I think, the challenge because out of sight, out of mind, the same problem with the oceans. You know, we don't see a lot of these things. And
right.
so we don't necessarily appreciate them, even if they're there doing the work for us. They're silently helping us, and they don't get credit for it, but they are there helping us. And I think, you know, aside from that, you know, when we talk about things like climate change, it doesn't relate for a lot of people. I think instead what we need to be talking about is this issue around our health, this issue around our security, is the issues that tie together to the opportunity that comes with dealing with climate change, clean energy, technology, smart cities. All of these can provide great jobs. And growth in this country that can provide opportunity and dignity to people to be able to work and make a living and feed their families, which is really what at the end of the day matters to all of us.
So you mentioned out of sight, out of mind, which is, I just found something that said out of sight, out of mind on the page. this question is, you're challenging the issue of out of sight, out of mind with your organization, Earth Eco International, by taking students to crucial ecosystems via virtual field trips. How important is it for kids to see these places as opposed to just reading about them? And let me unpack that a little bit more with a couple more questions. What's a virtual field trip? And how did you get into the idea of taking kids on virtual field trips to sort of understand what's going on with our climate?
Well, I always like to tell people the work that I do is not a product of my birth certificate saying that my last name is Cousteau. It's actually a product of a good teaching. I grew up with, the stories of my grandfather and my mother, who also spent 13 years on expedition, and the books and the films that they did. And that's what inspired me as a young person. I had good teachers, and we look at and believe that young people can really change the world and do change the world. And so we started Earth Eco about 14 years ago to continue on in the legacy of my father and grandfather, and to really look at empowering the next generation. And one of the ways, we do a lot of different programs. We have a global water quality program called the World Water Monitoring Challenge. We have a big youth STEM career program that we're launching this year. But another program is our expeditions, virtual field trips, taking young people out and getting them engaged. Because, you know, I visit schools all over the country. Heck, schools here in Los Angeles, where kids live a few miles from the ocean and have never been to the beach.
Right.
And so the reality is that even in coastal areas, a lot of young people don't get outdoors. We did a big field trip with a bunch of kids from Boys and Girls Club last year to the Bayona Wetlands out by LAX, which is just an incredible treasure I think a lot of people don't even realize exists in the middle of Los Angeles. And a lot of those kids had never seen anything like it, never been out in a wild wetland, and they're a few miles away.
Yeah, right? Absolutely.
And so we believe in the power of technology to be able to transport young people. So we are doing a lot with virtual reality now, but in the past, now that that technology is maturing, in the past, it's basically been, you know, we'll go out and film those. We can use Google Hangouts and bring kids live to these destinations, more in a 2D kind of experience.
And this is sort of, to people who are young and actually haven't seen some of the stuff that your family started doing in the, 50s?
Yeah, 40s, 50s.
50s. This is really the next logical step regarding the VR elements of this. A lot of people saw certain fish for the first time when your grandfather photographed these fish, right?
Yeah, absolutely. He co-invented scuba diving, Jacques Cousteau, and did underwater films and pioneered all of that. And now with virtual reality, we have an opportunity and live experiences, even in 2D, Google Hangouts, things like that, to bring young people
by live experience, do you mean like you're actually there, like you're underwater,
or above water, usually above water.
And you're like, hey, there's a porpoise. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, we can do live experiences. Exactly. Wherever we may be, we've done them from Florida and all over the place.
And do people ask questions and stuff? Mm-hmm. Have you done it on like a Periscope or any of those kind of, or like a Facebook Live?
No, we've used mostly Google Hangouts up until this point. It's just been the most useful because for a lot of different reasons with school limitations around Facebook and stuff like that. So.
Right. So, and do you go from school to school and kind of, are there multiple schools that watch this at the same time?
Yeah, we'll have hundreds of schools around the world, or sometimes thousands of schools participate around the world and watch in real time. Then watch the recordings, and then we film all of that, and then we put it on as education curriculum for schools and classrooms to teach concepts around water and carbon and
energy. So the connectivity nature of what's happened in the last 5 or so years has really helped take this sort of to the next level of education.
Oh my goodness. VR, augmented reality, AR, the technology
that exists. Which you would classify as that's the Google Hangout, is essentially – a little bit of augmented reality, because I mean they're watching and they're able to engage with what they're looking at.
A little bit. I'm but really
you're saying
excited.
Literally, about like how like we putting can. Pokemon Go in the ocean.
Literally, yeah, absolutely. Having kids be able to like have a coral reef appear in the middle of the classroom.
We have some noises over there. Hold on a second. We have to let people know.
There's a lot of important things happening.
I just want to make sure that nobody understands. We were talking about Pikachu on Pacific Ocean. As far as augmented, like, what would that look like?
So, for example, you could have a headset and you could see a coral reef appear in the middle of your classroom.
Okay.
And you could interact with it.
Wow.
And it's all kind of digital.
Can you do it the other way too? Where, like, if you're, let's say, on an expedition and you look either like at your phone like this and like this, like I'm just putting my phone up like where my hand is. You put your phone up and you could see information that you might want to know about that particular reef or whatever it is.
That is, I think we're a little ways away from that,
but we're getting closer.
No, we're getting closer. I think that it's more being able to project things into the real
side.
World.
Gotcha.
Kind of the other way that we can, so that you can experience and have interactions.
I'll start working on the other side of that.
Please. Being able to do that would be pretty incredible.
Yeah.
I'm sure we will at some point, but, you know, and then of course, virtual reality is really exciting.
Of course. Are you working with any particular virtual reality like companies or anything?
We are in negotiations right now with one.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll update everybody later. let's go back. I want to talk about two more things. Mm-hmm. The first one is World Monitoring Challenge, which is that what it is?
World Water Monitoring Challenge,
which I know a little bit about, but I'd love for you to speak further because I think it's super cool and I've seen the kits before and it's very exciting. And I think kids all over the country and the world should really do this with their classes.
Yeah, well, thank you. It's a program actually that is the world's largest citizen water quality testing program. And it's been around for about 13 years. It was started by the EPA about 13 years ago and we inherited it, or it was given to us essentially about a year ago. And we're actually going to be rebranding it the Earth Echo Water Challenge. And because World Water Monitoring Challenge is a bit of a mouthful. And
I forgot the water part of it.
Exactly. But it is in over 60 countries. Millions of people have participated around the world. And it's a really great example of how people can take control of understanding the quality of water in their communities into their own hands. Because as we saw in Flint here in the United States, we can't take it for granted.
Right.
And listen, there's
and you went to
thousands
Flint.
Of Flints
Flint
around
Flint
America
with,
right now.
With the water monitoring?
We have not because we don't test lead. We test other parameters, but we will be adding lead probably next year as a component. But right now we test pH.
What's
test
your favorite one that you've done so far?
Favorite test?
Yeah, favorite like classes in the
You know, I have to say that when we went to, we've done it, you know, I participate in tests all over this country. And we have students from Bangladesh and Taiwan and all over Africa and Brazil and Mexico and Europe. But my favorite was probably the one that we did here in the Biona wetlands. I don't know if you've ever been to Biona.
I have. I went on a field trip when I was really young.
It's incredible.
It's right across from Playa Vista, right?
Yeah. And we got to bring a bunch of kids who'd never seen anything like it. And then, you know, doing the testing with them and helping them connect the dots around why chemistry and science matters. To protect these places, that was a lot of fun.
It was a big deal when they had to. I don't remember when they had to protect it.
Yeah,
because the other side of it
went
away.
Continually fighting. Yeah, there was
a
huge development.
There was another side that EA Sports and YouTube and every Silicon Beach. That's all. Silicon Beach is all for you people out there that aren't in LA, and we don't want to sound like the Californians or anything, but Silicon Beach, which is like the LA version of Silicon Valley, is all on the other side of the Bellona wetlands, which I believe some of it was still a wetland.
They built over.
And then I didn't like Spielberg or someone bought it. Someone bought the real estate like before anyone decided to move over there. And now like there's one side is super developed and the other side is incredible still. It's still the wetlands all the way into Playa del Rey.
Yeah, they're still fighting all the time to make sure it stays protected.
Yeah.
Because of course developers are like, oh, they never saw a piece of natural land that they didn't want to.
But it's incredible. It's an aquifer, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not. It's a wetlands that helps to filter a lot of that water coming out of the basin of Los Angeles into the water. And in fact, if you look at old maps of the whole, pretty much that whole area were wetlands. All of Long Beach and the harbor down there were all wetlands.
Marina Del Rey, I'm guessing, was a wetland in Venice and all that. Yeah,
incredible. Yeah. And we just paved over all of it.
Yeah.
As we like to do.
So can you explain I guess the challenges and the positive impacts of what the water monitoring has done, you know, with this generation that you show them, and have you seen any sort of growth?
Yeah, well, we see young people having groups that take action to protect wetlands, get things cleaned up, protect rivers, investigate whole school groups, for example, in Colorado that were going up. What they found was just outside of Denver, they found they were doing regular testing in their river, and they found the pH level start to change pretty dramatically. And so they asked the question, well, what's going on? And they went upriver, and they found that there was a pipeline leaking chemicals into the river.
The kids found it.
The kids found
it. Incredible.
Despite that simple investigation of being like, wait, the pH is up to 8, which is unbelievable amount of acidity in the water. Something's wrong. So it's that simple process of like exploring the world around you, finding a problem, and then investigating and doing something about it. And these are the kinds of tools that actually, you know, when we all feel helpless and there's all sorts of bad things happening in the world and we don't know what we can do.
Yeah.
This is designed to be one of those programs where you can be like, you can pick up a kit, go out, find out where your local watershed is, because that's a lot of people don't even know where their water comes from. A lot
right.
of people here in LA have no idea where their water comes from.
Right.
It's not all just from the Colorado River. And do something about protecting it.
So this is where Jay cleverly, we put the word impact in there. So I'm actually going to gloss over that and just share a personal story. About, I'd say, 3 years ago, Philippe invited me to a private event at the Four Seasons Hotel. The first thing that was exciting about it was Jeff Ross was there, the stand-up comedian. Jeff Ross was there, and which was exciting to me. And
hysterical.
Yeah, because there was like 20 people there, and I'm like sitting next to Jeff Ross. but then the second thing that was exciting was I had literally never heard of this thing called impact investing, and Philippe really made it sound cool. I've never even heard of anyone make investment portfolio sound cool, but you know, Philippe sort of got up. We had a nice meal, and it was a handful of people. And Philippe said, "Hey, is that a weird sound? Yeah, there's something. The clicking sound is not. Yeah, it's not like a jaw or anything." Philippe started talking about impact investment portfolios and how if you cared about it, you could invest. You could tell your broker that the mortgage, the mutual fund portfolios, and your pension, and all of the money that you put into investments, your 401k, everything. You could tell the people who are investing that you only want to invest in specific things, and that there was an actual subsection of investment mutual fund portfolios called impact investment. And so a couple years later, we connected with a guy who was a very large impact investor named John Stewart, who at the time worked at Calvert. He has just recently taken Calvert to Eaton Vance, which is a much larger company. And we all started talking about how we could make a different kind of business conference. And the idea was, you know, there is this is going to get super wonky right now. There is SRI in the Rockies, which is like the biggest. I'm sure you've been there,
probably spoken there,
right? Yeah. But the idea was to sort of take all of the information from SRI, from, you know, what you get at the Milken, you know, conference, and then, you know, some of the really rewarding information that you get at places like Verge, and it's getting very loud, that thing, right? Okay. I'm just hearing things in my head. But taking all the information that you get at these green business conferences, and then you take all the stuff that you get at the impact investment conferences, put them together, and then kind of create a much more dynamic and fun, I don't want to say Hollywood, but entertainment-driven event that we would do, that Emma would do. And so, because we've done an award show for 27 years, it's sort of like the Green Golden Globes. And so, we decided we wanted to do something totally different, and we partnered with John Eaton Vance, with our friends at Toyota. We have, you know, we called all of our friends and said, hey, we want to do this thing. The head of our board, David Margulies, was very excited about it because he's in the investment world and in the development world. And the whole concept behind it is how to make a difference as a person. And what that means in all different facets. Mm-hmm. If you are someone who is going, you know, next week, I'm dating myself now, but this is right before the inauguration. If you're going next week and you're going to do the march with the women march, what is it called? Jay, is there a name for this thing?
I think it's the women's
march. March. Okay. So the women's march, right? Or if you were at Standing Rock, you know, as so many of us in our board were, or if you feel like your resources are better spent with literally investing in certain startups, or if you feel like, you know what, I spend $500,000 a year on mutual fund portfolios, and I'm going to divest all of my funds in away and into portfolios that are strictly impact investment portfolios. And so that's what we're kind of hoping for. And Philippe is going to be there. We have a bunch of other great people who will be there. We'll announce more soon. But I thought it would be great. We're announcing this for the very first time right now on the podcast. It's called Impact. It's the Impact Summit. And I thought it would be great if Philippe, if you told us a little bit about impact investment and how you came upon it.
Well, you know, in 2008, financial crash, running a nonprofit, hard to do, hard to raise money, as we all know. And I was frustrated with the state of the world, as so many people were, at least the financial world at the time. And a friend of mine suggested I look at Wall Street. I've never thought about Wall Street. And I thought to myself, no, they're aren't they the enemy? They've got Wall Street. This is why would I do that? I'm a conservation guy. And that was silly and short-sighted, because after a little bit of investigation, I realized that money talks and et cetera, walks. And I looked at the numbers. Annual charitable giving in the United States is about $300 billion. U.S. financial markets are worth $35 trillion. I thought to myself, how do I sit at that table? Like, that's where the action is. That's what changes the world. Nonprofits and NGOs are important, but insufficient to solve the problems that we need if we don't have industry and business moving the needle as well. And we start leveraging that kind of capital to solve problems. And so fast forward 2 years, and we launched the first exchange traded fund on the New York Stock Exchange that had a sustainable mandate, has a sustainable mandate. The ticker symbol is GIVE, G-I-V-E, because I like to walk the walk. I didn't just want to talk about it. So I got involved in the markets. I worked at the company that manages exchange traded funds. We launched an ETF, our own ETF called GIVE. And first of its kind on NYSE. And funny, the ticker symbol G-I-V-E, GIVE, was available on Wall Street. I can't imagine why that would be. So it's really an opportunity to recognize that charitable work and volunteering and how we vote for, all of those things are absolutely critical. But how we spend our money, what we buy, and also how we invest our money is also critical. I was at a conference or a gathering here in LA, I should say, not really even a conference, about GMOs. And there were a lot of very wealthy people in the audience, and they were all complaining about Monsanto and all these different companies and what they're doing with GMOs. And I got up and I asked a question. I said, how many of you have ever looked at your investment portfolios to see what you invest in? And nobody raised their hand. And I said, well, it's very likely that the mutual funds you own and all that stuff probably invest in Monsanto, Syngenta, Dow, BP, all these companies that you may be supporting a nonprofit to fight against. Then you're giving immeasurable, likely more money to support just by not knowing what's in your portfolio. And so I think the light bulb went off for some people, and certainly for me, in understanding that if you care about issues, you should align both how you spend your money, who you vote for, what you do in your community, as well as what you invest in to support those issues. And the common misnomer, and this is really important, Asher, is there is this rumor in the world that if you invest with ethics, you're going to sacrifice returns. That is complete bull.
Especially now.
If you look at the S&P performance and you look at the best sustainable investment funds out there, they track and sometimes outdo the S&P. So you don't have to invest in SIN stocks to make money.
But I want to go back to one thing really quickly, because I think that people don't understand. When you are IPO, and your stock that is traded and your company is no longer your company, mm-hmm. your company belongs to your shareholders. Mm-hmm. So this works negatively a lot of the time. For example, people say, well, McDonald's has been losing money for the last 7 years. Why don't they just adopt a, you know, more healthy menu? Mm-hmm. And the answer is not that simple, because they have to go to all their shareholders mm-hmm. and explain that for the next 10 years, they're going to be at an even bigger loss because they have to create a whole new business structure, right? Mm-hmm. But it works positively as well, because if you have a company that operates in a way that's a little easier to change things, and you say to General Electric is a great example of this. You say to General Electric, I'm a shareholder. I represent a lot of the shareholder money. And I think that you guys should be the new leader in green technology, right? And if enough shareholders say that, then you have what has happened. You have Predix, you have grid management, you have a whole new subsection of one of the oldest energy companies in the world that has decided that they're going to spend a lot of money to prove that they're the new leader in this, because that's what's gone in vogue, right? So I just want you to explain a little bit further that it's not just about making sure that you're not investing in the companies that you don't support. It's also about thinking a little bit longer term with the companies that you do invest in.
Well, you make a great point, Asher. And I actually don't like the term divestment, because typical kind of nonprofit do-goodery industry, it's a philosophy of deprivation. It's a philosophy of like what we shouldn't be doing in negativity. I much prefer what I think you're talking about, which is a reinvestment movement and starting to look for opportunities to say, hey, I want to be part of the future. I want to be part of companies that are embracing innovation and technology. Because what ends up happening is that you find a lot of these companies are the ones that in the short, medium, and long term outperform the market. It's been proven that companies that treat their employees better. So we're not just talking about environmental issues.
No.
It's often called ESG or environmental, yeah. social,
it's
and governance.
Always called
right?
ESG, right?
So the idea that both environmental, if nothing else, it's a risk mitigation. You're looking at companies that are being. I mean, BP's shareholders weren't happy about the oil spill, I can tell you, in the Gulf of Mexico. It didn't help anybody.
Well, especially because they were leading in ESGs for quite a while.
They were, which yeah. turned out to be a lot of smoke and mirrors.
Yes.
But the issue is, you know, environmental responsibility ends up being a better investment in risk mitigation. You have governance issues, oftentimes make sure that the company isn't kind of doing shenanigans and malarkey and behind the scenes, and you also have the opportunity to then have better equality in governance. You have a happier workforce, which always is better for a company if the people like working there, and issues around how they work with the community through their social
and basically, if you have
so it's a better investment right. in investing in a company that is doing the right thing than in a company that isn't.
And it's
that
obviously difficult to find some of the, there aren't that many heritage brands that have adopted that quickly to be ESG leaders. There are a few, I named GE, I know Campbell Soup is starting to acquire companies that can help them make a change, the non-GMO movement. Mm-hmm. But obviously where you really see the growth and where impact investment portfolios have grown majorly is you have some of these platforms and tech companies that have just overperformed every year over and over and over again. And they are all founded by people who are our age and younger, yeah. who believe truly in the principles of the ESGs. This is not just lip service. It's not just for shareholders. It's like, you know, not trying to single anyone out. But when you talk about Facebook, for example, you know, this is a company run by people who actually have the foresight to think about environmental ramifications mm-hmm. of things. So, and there are lots of people, there are lots of companies like that. It's not just one company. There's
and there are several. Some big companies, you know, GE is doing a lot of interesting things. You know, I just did a series with, United Technologies, which owns Pratt & Whitney and Carrier. And they're looking right. at a lot of, cause again, what they're finding is like, hey, listen, if we're able to actually increase jet fuel efficiency in our engines by whatever percent or, you know, increase the efficiency in our air conditioning units, not only is that good for the environment, it saves us and our customers money.
Sure.
So it makes business sense to use less fuel. It makes business sense to be able to be more efficient and use less energy. So there's a lot of big established Fortune 500, 100 companies that are going,
we've been working with We've been working with Toyota for over 16, 17 years, and they, you know, they were the first one to think that a hybrid would actually work.
Yep.
And now 75% of the automobiles on the road are hybrid. Yeah. I mean, now we're thinking of like new things. Yeah. I mean, we're thinking about like...
Well, now we got electric.
That's right. That's electric, we have a hydrogen.
Yep.
Yeah, fuel cell. There's so many... Yeah. Oh, you got to go soon?
In a few minutes,
Here, let me see if there's anything else in here that we can...
But your point is well
here
taken.
Here we go. Hold on. We got to plug some things. Yeah, this is good. All right. You should have put this at the end, Jay. This is a good one for the end. All right. Okay. So we talked about the Impact Summit. We'll talk about it more, but Philippe will be there and a bunch of other people. We'll send more information. If you want to check, I'll plug us first. If you want to check out anything about the summit, go to www.makeanimpact2017.com. Okay. So now you've worked on a number of shows, documentaries, and movies. And this is a two-parter. A, what role does storytelling play in saving the ocean? And B, what are the latest projects that we should know about that you are up to?
Well, I think that, story is the language of learning. Human beings, for our existence on this planet, have used story as a way to pass on knowledge and engage people. And I honestly believe that that the environmental movement has done a pretty poor job of telling story and engaging people. Great evidence at this last election that there wasn't any environmental questions in any of the debates. I mean, we still have failed to elevate these issues to where they should be. And I think a big way that we do that is by telling effective story. My grandfather and father were masters at this. Documentary on the Undersea World, the Jacques Cousteau series, lasted for 30, 40 years around the world, and opened people's eyes. And because at first it was an adventure, it was joyful, it was exciting. It wasn't doom and gloom. We're too focused on the negativity, I think, these days in the movement. And so good story is absolutely critical to engaging people and entertaining them and teaching them something. And so we have a lot of programs we're really excited about. Our second season of a series called The Aquatic World of Philippe Cousteau just aired on greatbigstory.com, which is CNN's digital platform.
Great.
And that's actually a scripted show all about the oceans with real science in it and real scientists. It's a totally new genre, scripted, unscripted, we call it.
And it's on CNN.com?
It's on greatbigstory.com.
Greatbigstory.com.
And then we had the number one show on Shark Week last summer.
Are you going to do it again?
We're not doing Shark Week again this year. We're working on a new series with Travel Channel, actually.
Okay, great. That was fun.
And that was a great show. And like I said, we're putting a deal together for a bunch of virtual reality.
Great.
We're actually working on a scripted show, like a series right now that kind of looks at all these issues, kind of global conspiracy theory series.
Yep.
So lots of different things in the works, always having fun.
And where can people fall other than, I think we have a page for you guys on our website.
Yes, which is great.
We have a celebrity missions page for Philippe on our website, greenforemma.com and .org. But where can people keep track of everything with you?
Social media is just P. Cousteau on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, and then philippecousteau.com as well. I was trying to keep putting up our new projects on our website. So
great.
Thanks
okay,
very much,
this
man.
Is great. And
it.
Please tell Ashlyn.
I will. She's in Antarctica right now. So
without you?
Yeah, I will. Yeah, I know.
Jesus. When the first time that I met Philippe and his beautiful wife, Ashlyn, they were not married yet. She said she had never gone anywhere.
Certainly not like spending a night sleeping on
come
the
ice. Come on. Well, Ashlyn, that looks very fun.
She's killing it. You
guys got married and now she's the one doing the adventure.
I'm telling you, she's down 6 days on the ice in Antarctica.
That's incredible. So, that's amazing. All right. Well, so good talking to you, man.
Pleasure, Ashlyn. Thanks, Betty. Always, man.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.